Is it a dumb game, or am I just dumb? Dumb.
What's dropping?
If you are looking for relevant gaming coverage from experts, you are not getting it on this show.
I'm running hot. I got a lot to talk about at the top of the show.
I'm excited.
First of all, I think I've forgotten one of those things, but maybe I'll remember it.
Okay.
Because I definitely remember two.
Okay.
The first thing, I was at a hot new restaurant last night. One of the hottest restaurants in Oakland. It's sizzling.
Can you name drop?
It's called Penrose.
I've never heard of it, so it's not that hot. But go on.
It's one of those places that you can barely tell where you're at when you enter it. You're kind of like looking around for any kind of signage. It barely exists. Like, they put the name of the restaurant maybe 3 inches from the concrete on like the bottom right corner of the restaurant.
It's like that line in Swingers. It's like it's a speakeasy sort of deal.
Yeah. That continues to be the big gimmick. So, get into this place. It's your standard kind of hipster joint with your nouveau industrial aesthetic, but they at least have a few flourishes. But person I'm with goes to the bathroom, comes back and reports that this place is indulging in one of the worst trends in, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe interior design, maybe even architectural design.
Bathroom history.
What?
She went to the bathroom, so did she see... I thought you were, the story was going toward she encountered something that was terrible in the bathroom.
in all of the history of bathrooms. Yeah, in all the tomes that have been written about bathrooms. This has more to do with the design of bathrooms. Chris, I know you are one of the leading experts.
Of course.
In bathroom design and bathroom use.
I've spent 3/4 of my life inside bathrooms. I know what's going on.
A rough figure. So this is something, I don't even know that you've encountered this, but frosted glass in bathrooms. Have you had to deal with this hellish reality?
I'm trying to figure out where is it put. You mean like the...
Oh, it's put where exactly where you don't want it to be put. Think of frosted glass.
Yeah.
Then think of the last place on the fucking planet you'd want that frosted glass to be placed.
Well, the last place, of course, would be just beneath the seat so that my poop curls up and touches my butt. But the second to last
place... The second to last.
Of course, would be the stall doors.
Yes. Now, that's awful enough. So you think of a bathroom in which you and a bunch of other people with penises are subjected to a bunch of stall doors with frosted glass so that you could see other people with penises or, you know, just people who, you know, consider themselves male or whatever, taking various types of shits or doing whatever might be done in a stall, like a line of coke.
Right.
Or just, you know,
jacking it.
Just jacking it. Just stroking. Now, it can get worse, of course, because another popular thing in these restaurants is to not have, and I'm all for this, they have single serving restrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of that. I love, because, you know, there's nothing worse than going to a fancy swanky place or being with a group of people and all of a sudden you're milling about in a shitstorm, a literal shitstorm with other people in between dining. Like, maybe you're just hoping to take a piss and you're just hearing someone, you know, there's like a Pearl Harbor-esque battle occurring in a stall next to you. No, this place is like, we'll have single-serving restrooms, but just to make your experience worse, we're gonna have frosted glass on the doors entering the single-serving restrooms.
This is terrible.
Imagine this. So there's like a narrow hallway, and then on your left is the women's, straight ahead is the men's. And this is a super popular place that I had to wait an hour and a half to get a fucking seat in. So you can imagine, in a place of this size and popularity, the amount of traffic going to these two bathrooms. It's very heavy. There's always at least two people waiting to go to the bathroom. Meanwhile, the people currently in the bathroom are separated by doors that look like your standard private eye door.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, it's like you're wandering into a police station in 1954.
It's exactly like that. And what they do is they light the interior with candles. And I think the intention is to certainly set some kind of mood, but also to, like, kind of obscure what's going on in there, because you can see right inside. Right. It's just frosted glass. So I think they hope that the candles will create these little orbs of light that make it a little bit more mysterious. But no, it doesn't. So I line up and queue up for these bathrooms. There's another woman waiting there, and there's people in both bathrooms. And the woman next to me is drunk and is like, "Is there someone in there? I can't tell. I see. I is that a jacket or is that part of the design?" I'm like, "I think someone's in there." And she goes to, like, work the handle. So finally the person finishes up. I can see them on the toilet. I can see them rise to the toilet. I can see them pull up their pants.
Oh, my God.
I can see them put on their jacket. Door opens. It's my waitress.
Oh, no.
And she goes, "I can hear everything you guys were saying." Like, with this, you know, and she was saying it like, "Oh my, I can't believe I work at this fucking place." Yeah, okay. and this is where I have to, you know, piss and shit all the time.
Yeah. Oh my
so,
God.
Lo and behold, it's my time to come up, and I'm, you know, breathing easy because there's no one in line behind me. Mm-hmm. So I get in there. I'm like, "Okay, I'm free and clear," because I'm at the one where when you come into the hallway, I'm at your 12 o'clock.
Right.
And at your 10 o'clock or whatever is the women's bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're queuing up, where are you going to stare? There's no, I mean, you stare, you go to your, you know, 3 o'clock and stare at a fucking wall.
Right.
So I get up in there. I'm all happy because there's no one there. Immediately, two people queue up. And they're like, I just was thinking that the person in there can't really hear you. But of course they can. I'm at the urinal. So imagine the urinal is right against the wall, like, you know, right by the door almost.
Right.
So you look in the door, you're looking at the urinal on your left-hand side.
And you can see, like, someone profile, like, just
yes.
pissing away.
And that's me, lit like a Cinemax porno.
You know, if this becomes a really popular trend, I will start, like, packing a dildo with me, and I'll just
yes!
I'll just unfurl that so everyone marvels at the size of my dick.
I was thinking the same thing, because I get my dick out, it's in profile, lit from behind, like Plato's cave.
You're a shadow puppet.
And I know that they know that that they're seeing everything. Oh, but to make everything worse and to punctuate the moment, the woman and the guy, they're clearly a couple, are narrating this whole experience. Because everyone, I imagine, that experiences this is going through the shock of this. And they're like, the woman says, as I'm pissing, she goes, "I can see everything in there." Dick is out. And I know what she's talking about.
Oh,
you know, like, it's
yeah.
So what I did was, when I exited, I just, like, I opened the door, I looked at both of them and just kind of shook my head. And there was this moment of recognition. And I got back to my seat, and I was just telling everyone I was with, I was like, this is like, because the other thing they do at this place is they have communal tables where it's all about, like, it's a social atmosphere, like, you might meet new people.
Fuck that.
You know, which is just a ruse, a capitalistic ruse to maximize floor space and treat all of your customers like shit.
Yep.
Of course. It's like, oh, we make seats so close together in airplanes because we want everyone to be friends, you know. It's bullshit. So when I get back to my seat, I'm like, I just saw basically our waitress's vag. And now, like, there's this whole air of excitement and mystery in the place, because everyone around you, not only are you sitting shoulder to shoulder with them, but you're basically seeing them in their most private moments.
Right.
Good God. It's like, it's the ultimate nightmare for this. And I can only imagine people that are like, you know, thankfully I'm not on a first date or something. People would go on first dates and then maybe both go up to the bathroom together or catch them each other in there. And God forbid someone's having a bad night.
If I were with somebody, like if I had a long-term partner, and I would go into the bathroom with them and pee between their legs so people from the outside would see the silhouette of a man pissing on a woman.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential. Denizens of the Bay Area, go to Penrose in Oakland, right by the Grand Lake Theater, and plan some risque shadow puppeting, because there's a potential.
Not since piss troughs has there been a worse design in bathrooms.
So, Chris, I think we're due for another dating update.
Oh boy, you guys want to hear a little bit? You guys want to hear a little bit of what this Lothario is up to? I understand. Listen, I went out on a date. What day was that? That was 2 days ago. Whatever day that was.
Thursday? I think it was a Thursday.
Okay, so I went out on a date. You know, casual kind of deal. Just meet at 7 o'clock. We'll have a couple beers and part ways. See if we like one another. I had already discussed with you who this gal is. She wasn't your top pick for me out of the stable of women that I'm able to choose from.
Extensive stable.
But, as it turns out, the front runner going into the week, the lady who had pole position, ended up flaking out entirely. Like, I don't know what her gimmick is. Neither do you. We can't figure this out. Well, actually, you've encountered it before, so I don't know if there's a name for it, but it's just these people who are, like, in your face, and they're like, yeah, we gotta go out, and then, like, radio silence, that's after they get your excitement up. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go out, well, I'll go out with you, and then nothing. And you're like, well, what the fuck? You got me all worked up over nothing. That gal's out of my life, I don't care. She's dead to me.
Pole position lost. Beefed it on turn two, didn't ride the apex well, hit a wall. And guess what?
Dale Earnhardt had right out of this life.
Danny Waltrip used that to his advantage.
That's right. Well, you know, again, let's not confuse our pronouns here. This is a she. And so I went out with a gal, and she's...
And does Danny Waltrip even exist? There's some Waltrip.
I think it's Daryl. Isn't it Daryl Waltrip? Daryl Waltrip. Yeah, the D, right? I don't know. So, yeah, went out on a very casual date. Good conversation. I don't think I want to bore people with the details of that specifically. I think the issue now is the second date. I think that is harder than the first date.
Yes, there's no question, because the first date is so prescriptive.
Yeah.
Generally, it's just let's meet, let's make sure no one's stabbing the other.
Right.
You know, it's just, you just want to get any potential stabbings out of the way.
Exactly.
And you're just verifying that the person is a human being, which, you know, this has come in handy with me, is that I've had first dates where I verified that this is not a human being and that I've got to back out of this.
Ugh.
So you've at least gotten to the stage where, okay, we both verified each other.
Yeah.
Is A human being, and B will not stab me.
Right. I mean, and those words were pretty much exchanged at the end of the night, because we did have a good time. The conversation actually did take a nice turn on that first date, because we ended up, I know you're not supposed to, but we ended up talking politics, and she's got the exact same leaning attitude on politics that I do. So, like, it was really refreshing to talk about that. But at the end of the night, you know, I gave her a hug and I said, you know, we should do this again. And she mentioned watching a movie that we actually initially bonded over. She said, we should watch that together. And I said, okay, well, I mean, we could watch it at my place, or I can bring it to your place. And she goes, well, I can tell you're not a murderer, so we can watch it at your place. As it turns out, that movie is the hit film Bottle Rocket, which is beloved to you and I. It is the greatest film of all time, the most quotable film of all time as well. And what I find interesting is on the second date, I'll be watching a movie that I didn't watch with my ex-girlfriend of 7 years. once.
And why is that? You know, you'd think in any other relationship, listeners, you would imagine that your favorite movie you'd share with your significant other of 7 years. But for some reason, that never occurred.
That's right. Well, it's because I approach this movie with great intensity, high intensity, to quote the film itself. I'm so in love with it. And this is a personality trait of mine that you either, I think it's, you either, it's a black or white thing. You either love it or you hate it. If I love something, I go nuts about it. And I can sometimes try to oversell it. And I think for 7 straight years, I was overselling this movie. And it got to a point where it was no longer even a thing that we could do together because I maybe built it up too much. Or she was worried that I was going to talk over it and laugh over it too much. Which I would probably be laughing nonstop because I laugh at that movie. Almost 100% of the film I'm laughing. So
it became this mythical thing that could have decided the relationship in a way on a variety of different levels. Like, if she didn't like it, mm-hmm. how would you ever recover?
It's true. It could have sent us into a nosedive.
Yeah. Like,
earlier than it, other circumstances sent us into a nosedive.
This is how significant this movie is to our lives, is that it holds this thing that I use to judge the character and quality of other individuals.
That's right.
Like, if they don't like this movie, suddenly I'm like, well, clearly you're a moron. Like, I can't.
What kind of character flaw do you have? Because there's no way to not love the movie.
There's few other things in my life that I hold at this level of esteem and also consider to be this unassailable in quality.
I am forgiving of people who are religious. I would date someone who's religious. I know that kind of goes against what you believe in a way, but
yeah, I would not.
But I would make concessions for somebody who said, well, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic, but I don't care if you're an atheist or whatever. But if they then said, but I will not watch Bottle Rocket, or more importantly, if they said, I've watched it and I disliked it, I would head for Z Hills. It would be over. So this is like, and it's nice because she and I have a shared interest. She can quote the film, which is, I've never experienced a gal who's been able to quote the movie ever. So that's an exciting thing. But it's the second date, and there's this part of me that wonders, what if we don't have anything to talk about? What if I don't know what the... I'm worried about that, so...
You know what? You've gotten the hard part of the way, though, because I feel like the tough part of the second date is structuring it, and that the structure has already been laid. But now things have gotten a little bit more intense because it's at your own house, and, like, now, you know, she's got to...
The hardest part is, like, I'm writing her an email back, and in writing it, I have to give instructions on where she can park, you know, her options for parking. I also have to explain, like, look, the reality is I don't own a couch. I'm, you know.
I forgot about that.
I just have a lazy boy and a gamer chair. I got a couple of bar stools. It's a penthouse bachelor pad. I do have a couple. I do have a couple of...
It's either a penthouse bachelor pad or, like, a place that a formerly well-off person who acquired a meth habit owns that had to sell off anything of value.
I do have 2 inflatable mattresses I can put side by side and throw a queen-size sheet over. If she wants to take a roll in the hay.
Like, I imagine her coming and knocking on the door, and you're like, it's open. And she opens the door, and you're just, like, sprawled out in, like, tiger pose on the inflatable mattresses.
On these olive drab green mattresses. My apartment is as sterile as an art gallery. You've been in it. I mean, that's what it's like in here.
Without any of the art.
Oh, God. Wow. So that's the longest introductory, or whatever we call that segment of the show. That's the longest one we've ever done.
Yeah, and this is super dumb games. This is a podcast about video games, and
we just ran the gamut of dating and shitting and restaurants and living the bachelor life. So,
but we've got a lot of good video game content coming up. The only strange thing is neither of us really played any games this week.
That was the big reveal. As soon as you said that, I was like, I didn't play shit.
I did play very briefly one game.
Okay.
That connects to Bottle Rocket in a way that like Bottle Rocket, Minecraft is one of my favorite things of all time in video gaming. It's one of those games that is in the pantheon, probably top 5 to top 10 all-time games for me. And there's this other game called Terraria that started off, I remember when it first came out, it was like, oh, this is just a Minecraft ripoff, and I kind of dismissed it. It's essentially Minecraft in 2D, if you can imagine that. And it's been around for quite a while now. I think it maybe came out in 2011 officially, but I think it did one of those things like Minecraft that it was in alpha and beta releases and that kind of thing. And I dismissed it for a long time. I had owned it for a long time. I think maybe even you bought it, or someone bought all of our friends' copies.
Yeah, we all got a copy of it under the guise that we would get together and play this like we do Minecraft, and it didn't interest me. I mean, I saw the way it worked and the mechanics and the 2D side-scrolling action, and I mean, it reminded me a lot of really any side scroller that you've ever played. It's very similar, at least in look, but a little bit more polished. It didn't capture me. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to follow up, is because you have such strong identity with Minecraft, especially in that genre, which Minecraft essentially created. Mm-hmm. You imagine it as a 3D experience, this immersive dungeon delving kind of thing, and Terraria takes you out of that. Suddenly, you see your character on the screen, you know, and you're digging in 2D. It's a hard thing to get over, because your initial reaction is, well, this is shit. This isn't like Minecraft. So that was kind of, I played it once and I was like, I'm just not getting this. I gave it a second go and it started to click for me, because I dug a little bit deeper and I was starting to see that the thing with Terraria is that it's more RPG heavy than Minecraft is.
Which is a huge plus, because I think that's the one element I've always missed from Minecraft, is that there isn't a good RPG element to it.
Yeah, there's not. With Minecraft, you have to kind of, you know, of course, they introduced the Nether and dragon, a big dragon, and some NPC villages and all that kind of stuff. But it's still, you have to really get by on just pure creating and discovery. Whereas Terraria has a ton of lootable items that have really cool effects and benefits, and a massive library of varied creatures. And from what I can tell, a kind of leveling progression and progression in technology that feels very RPG-like. So it's almost instantly, you know, you build your house just like Minecraft, and then you start digging, and you very quickly discover that, well, this is there, you know, you're constantly getting attacked by enemies, and, you know, they're dropping interesting things, and you start to look on your crafting table, and it seems like a wider variation of stuff you can create, and it leans a bit heavier on fantasy and sci-fi and that kind of thing. And it's starting to make sense to me. It's no, you know, it's not on the same tier as Minecraft, I don't think, but it's starting to make sense in a way that I'm beginning to crave playing it. And I'm excited to see where it will go. For those that were like me, that kind of dismissed it, I would give it another shot. And I would also take a look at another game that's in development right now called Starbound, that, like Terraria, is a 2D Minecraft, but the twist is you have a spaceship that could travel to other planets.
Nice.
And that seems to have a ton of potential, because, so of course you have your different areas that occur as you dig deep, but, you know, Terraria kind of loses that really amazing biome flavor of Minecraft, but Starbound returns it by allowing you to get in a ship and just go to a whole new place where there's different civilizations and enemies who have created bases and crazy shit. But it got me thinking about something that I'd like to dig into a little bit deeper in our third segment, which is games throughout your gaming history in which you made stuff. So games that function in some sense, whether it's really explicitly like Minecraft, you know, platforms for the creation of stuff in a game, or maybe other interpretations of that, to where you maybe created particular kind of stories or did certain role playing or used a kind of art software like a Mario Paint, for instance, but you actually used a game to build and create. And I want to explore that in the third segment, but first, news.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second segment of the Super Dumb Games podcast, where we explore all the latest gaming news, dissect it, and ultimately forget we ever even talked about it. Our first segment shouldn't come as any surprise to you. It's the... What is it ranked among the three segments? I can't remember.
I think right now, like if you look at the big board,
yeah,
it's sitting in the two slot.
This week it's jockeying for pole position. I didn't mean to put that out there again.
this episode should be subtitled pole position.
That's right.
Episode 22: : pole position.
What's dropping? I'll tell you what's dropping. Warehouse and Logistics Simulator 2014!
Of course.
Tanner, you know, it always seems like we go to these sim games, but they are the ones producing the dumbest stuff.
Every aspect of life, by the time we croak, will have been simulated. There's going to be a frosted glass bathroom simulator, at least, you know, in the next 6 months.
Complete with, like, you know, dick silhouette DLC, you know. Tanner, are you ready for your new challenge?
Well, tell me about the challenge, and I'll let you know if I'm ready for it.
Well, get ready to take over the control of your original Jugendrick forklift. Just the best drivers will level up in the high score list. The fastest drivers will receive a special bonus. Enjoy the game in full 3D and feel the realistic driving experience. This dropped on 25 February 2014. Mark that on your calendars. Should be a new national holiday.
First of all, there's a few things going on here. Number one, I love how they always list the make and model of this like obscure machinery as if there's a fan base or something. And,
well, there is. It's the autistic people like, of the world.
You announce a new Gran Turismo or Forza, and you say that they've got the new Aston Martin or Ferrari. It's like, yeah, okay, I could get on board with that. But right. I don't know that this forklift.
I don't even know if I pronounce it right. Jungheinrich? It's spelled Jungheinrich. I don't know.
And you know your game doesn't have a lot of exciting stuff to offer when, like, top build is 3D. Like,
right.
Like, they're proud of the fact that they at least purchased and used a 3D engine to make this game.
Ladies and gentlemen, I work with material handling equipment and construction equipment, and I have never heard of this forklift. I have shipped fleets of forklifts overseas, and I have no idea what they're talking about here. But let's just talk about a few of the key features this game has, okay? They needed to reiterate this in a bullet point. Original Jugendrick forklifts. They're just hammering this Jungheinrich forklift thing home.
You know, John Deere or Caterpillar DLC has got to be coming up, right?
Get ready for the DLC, because it's going to blow your fucking mind. First off, though, second bullet point, huge variety of quests. Third point, different...
Yeah, I can imagine that variety. Like... Take this, this game boils down quests into their essence, their shitty essence, which is take this fucking thing and put this thing over there, what other variety is possible? Like, do it in reverse?
In the video that they show for it, it's just literally a guy, well, in one of them, you're in a warehouse, and... You're picking up pallets, of course, and you move them from one place to another. And then sometimes the difficulties increase because that pallet is on the second tier. It's not on the floor.
Oh,
so
man.
You gotta lift. Yeah, you gotta raise it up and then put it in and then bring it out and back up. But there was one that looked especially exciting. You were in a grocery store and you were putting a box of fruit down by the produce section. I for one, was looking forward to that quest.
I think they have a fundamental misunderstanding of what quests and variety mean.
They have different game modes. What they are, I don't know. They don't tell you. I guess maybe normal difficulty, hard difficulty, realistic versus arcade mode. I don't know.
Like, it's probably like Gran Turismo, like drive a forklift on the moon.
Realistic physics, which I hope means you can like impale a coworker accidentally and their body moves the same way that would happen if you did that in real life.
One strange thing about all these simulator games, and correct me if I'm wrong, corrections department, but they never include collision detection. So they'll have people. I've watched a giant bomb play a lot of these things, and you can never run into anyone because that would, of course, require too much engineering expertise and probably be too expensive.
Yep. Well, so where they did put a lot of their money, though, is in the fifth bullet point and the final one under features, which is different detailed 3D scenarios like supermarket, port, or construction zone.
Wow. Exciting. I mean, each of those is more tantalizing than the last.
Listen, potential buyers, make sure your hard drive has at least 1 gigabyte of available space. That's the minimum here, okay? And if we're looking at what's recommended, we need 2 gigabytes of RAM. I mean, no lower. Otherwise, it's going to completely destroy the experience. This is an all-immersive game. And guess what, Tanner? They have DLC that just came out, too. Can you guess what they might possibly do with this DLC? Like, what kind of content would they add to this game?
So there's two options. It's either different types of forklifts or different brands of forklifts. Uh-huh. Or they may... Even though the players are the same, they may change the game on us. And they may add in totally different kind of hauling equipment, but that seems like a stretch.
Now, so I want you to think of like what the hottest type of game there is out there. You know, like a game, how would you put
right
it?
Right now, the hottest game is Titanfall.
Okay, not that game. Think of like a NPC that you find in a lot of games, and it's all the rage because people love it because they love. Fuck it! Buy the DLC! Hell's Warehouse! That's right, ladies and gentlemen. You could be a forklift operator in Hell's Warehouse.
Are you kidding me?
Is this
DLC endorsed by Judas Priest?
This is not going to be a typical shift at the distribution center. Okay, something sinister is creeping through the aisles and climbing the racks of this devilish depot, and it's up to you to battle this zombie apocalypse.
Oh my god.
The warehouse floor has been transformed into your arena, so toss out the safety rules, because that's a big deal in the original game. Without the DLC, you know, you really got to follow OSHA standards and things like that. You get extra points, I imagine, for doing so. But toss out those OSHA rules and standard procedures. Here's a game where you must go postal to survive and win. Use forklifts to blast these deadheads and tear them to pieces. Do you have what it takes to stop this zombie assault? I don't, personally, but show the undead who's the boss, because this is one work shift you must finish. Your life depends on it. Clock in, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm trying to imagine the human being that would choose to just to do this with their gaming time. Like, I can understand the person who is super into logistics and warehousing and all that stuff and just kind of finds it fun. And, you know, it's a way to organize your life and get some control over things. But then to reskin that game into the form that a million other games do so much better, mm-hmm. and to take away every essence of this game and make it suddenly a zombie shooter, it makes no sense whatsoever. I can't imagine the market that would get excited about that.
Well, it made sense to them. So a few of the key features. Ingenious horror in B-movie style. This is the best bullet point, because you remember I told you about the 3D scenarios like the supermarket, harbors, and construction sites. This bullet point reads, different detailed 3D scenarios like supermarkets, harbors, and construction sites. Doesn't give you any clue as to how different they might be. Realistic equipment models and a wide range of weapons, bombs, and mines to choose from. That just, it doesn't even sound fun anymore, honestly. I think the only way that this would be fun is for the 5 minutes of fun that you would have impaling zombies. The other stuff is just superfluous.
It's like taking a flight sim and adding DLC where you drag race the planes.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't compute. Yeah. God bless them, though. I love that these things, every week there's a new one.
There's a new one. And so the last two things, if I haven't sold you yet, and God knows I've sold all of you, I guarantee it. It's packed with a variety of tasks, and exciting modes like survival mode are embedded in it. That's only $3.99 in addition to, and it's the deal only runs for a few days after you listen to this podcast, so get on top of it. The game itself is down to $11.99, $3.99 with the DLC. That's a steal for $15, ladies and gentlemen.
I learned yesterday from a homeless person that I gave a dollar to that that is $1 more than the cost of a piece of chicken and a biscuit, which is $2.99 at Church's.
Oh, boy. We're moving on to the next segment. This is your top sizzlers. And I think we're in store for some updates to a few stories that we've touched on previously. And I think the biggest update, and this, I don't know if you read about this yet, Tanner, but this is incredible news, I think. They did it, ladies and gentlemen. Twitch TV plays Pokemon. They beat the game.
Oh my God.
Goddamn right.
I didn't hear about this.
Yep, they beat the game. They beat it after 15 days, 17 hours, and 10 minutes, I believe. Or no, sorry, 16 days, 7 hours, 45 minutes, and 30 seconds is
Wait,
when they beat
so-
it.
Wait, so... Do some quick math here. What is 15 days times 24, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't get my fucking calculator up. That's over like 300 hours.
It's 360 hours worth.
Oh my God.
They put in close to 400 hours on this game.
That's like 20 hours shy of what you've put into Pinball Arcade.
The thing that makes me sad right now is I don't know how Pokemon works, so I'm reading through what they did. So it'll say, for instance, they got a Pokemon, but then released Pokemon. I don't know what that means. Do you get a Pokemon and then you...
So the central mechanic of the game is you're a dude and you go around in the wild. You start with one Pokemon, which you choose, but then you go around the wild and you encounter other Pokemon that you can tame and catch.
Yeah.
But then once you have them in your stable, you can also just release them so that to make room for more. So you have a stable of Pokemon that you use in battle depending on the scenario. It's kind of you've got to use them strategically, and you only have a set amount of slots.
So it's like your deck of cards, basically.
Yeah.
Got you. What's funny is it looks like they got to name some of the Pokemon. I guess that might be something that you can do in the game. So
yeah,
like one of them they named just Spearow. It's like this dead looking bird. One of them was named JLVWNNOOOOO, and which they nicknamed Jay Leno because of the way that that all comes together. Another one was just ABBBBBBBK parenthesis, and they named that one Abby. There was one that was just CCC, which they nicknamed C3KO. So most of them were names with like AAA. One of them was named Dukes, like Frank Dukes. That's pretty cool. Some of the notable events, I guess, they defeated Blue on SSN, made it past the ledge, entered Lavender Town, entered Erica's gym, bought Soda Pop, entered, I don't know what this means. It all culminated with entering Victory Road on the 14th day, the 9th hour, the 50th minute. They exited it at 15 days, 17 hours, 10 minutes, and finally beat the game at 16 days. They earned all the badges that you can earn.
It truly is one of my favorite gaming things of all time. It's so brilliant and amazing. And I want someone to do a story about the guy who started this, because I think he's been pretty much anonymous since he started it. Like, he created this touchstone moment in gaming history, but we know nothing about him.
I'll put the link up because it's a Google document that they've got that shows all the goals, and they do have a video of the final battle and the credits. So I'll link that in the show notes so that everyone can check it out. I wish I could speak more to the game, but as you all know, I have an aversion to this game. I don't like it. I don't give a shit about it. I'll never play it.
And it has to do with your generational bias, I think, in that you dismiss it because for the generation that came up immediately following us, Pokemon is the game of games.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's like their Pog, but I didn't even get into Pog. You know, like I was still living in the Frisbee era when I was a kid, so it's fucking, none of it makes sense to me. Let's move on to another update, because we touched on the fact that the makers of Candy Crush Saga King I don't know. I think they just go by King.
Yeah.
So last time we checked in with them, they were trying to get a trademark on the word Saga, thereby making any game with the name Saga in it have to either pay a royalty or not be allowed to name their game that way, I imagine. Their latest thing was that they were trying to trademark the dictionary word candy. So the company confirmed today that it has filed for express abandonment of that trademark filing, as noted by a request on file with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to read the story word for word. I think this just speaks to the greed and... I mean, these guys are trillionaires right now, and they're trying to just put their hooks in the market in a way that I think is despicable, and it honestly... It leaves such a bad taste in my mouth. I don't ever want to... I wouldn't play one of their games because they don't interest me. But if they even come out with a game that I would care for, I don't think I would play it or buy it or anything like that. It just seems silly now.
Yeah, and I'm very curious as to if their backing out of that candy trademark bid has to do with the just colossal amount of bad press they got from it. Like, I have the suspicion that they thought they could kind of get away with that and not call too much attention to it. But, you know, like the whole Saga furor, which really rose up because the Banner Saga was, a small game that some people really liked and was getting contested by this trademark of Candy Crush, then called attention, I think, to all of their trademarks, and someone found the candy trademark. And I have a feeling that they were like, we want to do this, but it's going to cost too much.
You know, first, the name Candy has been featured in gaming since Candyland is the first game that comes to mind, right? So if we're talking intellectual property, I can't imagine anyone being able to protect that word and claim that that's intellectual property to put the name Candy in a title of a game. And interestingly enough, there was a game back in 2004 called Candy Swipe, and it's still on the Google Play Store, despite all of these attempts to get rid of any games with the name Candy or whatever to claim that intellectual property. And what's funny is that if you go to the Google Play Store and look at the reviews for Candy Swipe, which again predates Candy Crusher, it is just flooded with 5-star reviews. And a lot of it is people saying how much they hate King and this whole Candy Crush debacle.
Yeah, there's a whole story behind that Candy Swipe game where it was some guy and, like, I don't know, someone in his family had cancer or something and he had to quit his job. And, like, that game was becoming his primary source of revenue.
Holy shit.
And he created this game before Candy Crush ever existed. And then King found out about Candy Swipe after Candy Crush broke big. And they've tried to get that game taken down. So the guy posted this blog post like, listen, this is my livelihood. I was here first. You're trying to ruin my life.
God. That's horrifying.
But, you know, I've heard a rumor that King really started all of these trademark bids because they went on Shark Tank and they got shot down because there was nothing proprietary about their products.
What's to stop me from hiring a few tech goons right now and squashing you like the cockroach that you are?
We're the only two people who will enjoy this, that riff.
On to the next top sizzler. This one I think is actually really interesting, given that The subject of this story is the famous, or perhaps you might call him infamous, Peter Molyneux. And of course, I first was exposed to his games through Populous and then Black and White when that came out on the PC. He has since then, you know, he's done the Fable series, which I played, I think, Fable 1 and then Fable 3, I want to say. This is coming from developonline.net. He is quoted as saying, "I will never make my perfect game." And he believes that no matter how hard he tries, the perfect games he imagines will never quite come to fruition. This is a man who has disappointed fans time and again. And I think the issue is he oversells the ability of his games to provide certain mechanics that he can't do, that no one can do.
It's one of the wonderful things about him that he's become a kind of fan favorite game designer, because he has a certain whimsy about himself and like an imagination that he he refuses to tame through PR conditioning,
mm-hmm.
where everybody else is so trained to not oversell games and hit on a certain set of talking points. Peter Molyneux will like design a game in his head and then announce it the next day.
Yeah.
And make these claims that like a Peter Molyneux game reminds me of this toy from the 80s. Chris, you probably know the name of, where the whole concept was you had action figures you'd set up, you know, in your room,
mm-hmm.
and you'd play a video, and the video would shoot stuff at the action figures. Like, the action figures were supposed to take damage from battles occurring in the video. Do you remember that toy?
Not with action figures. I'm trying to think here. Like,
I forget what it was called, but the whole premise was...
But it was like a laser tag kind of deal?
Yeah, with the action figures in the TV show. And they sold this thing, like, in my mind, my Molyneux-esque kid brain, I was imagining my action figures, like, moving on the ground and blowing up and all this stuff. And that's kind of how they sold it. In those days, they would sell you this vision... And even in gaming history, like, they'd sell you CG trailers, and then you'd get the game, and it's just like a couple blocks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have this vision of this grand game, and Molyneux still does that. For all his games, he'll sell you this vision, this life-altering concept for a game, and then you get the game, and it's like, it's yet another version of Populous.
Yeah. Well, what's most interesting is he's a bit delusional, Peter is, because... When he talks about this, he's saying, I'll never make my perfect game. But then he goes on to basically say that the creative process is subject to empirical decay from inception to final product, which prevents him from creating the masterpiece he has been striving for. In other words, he's putting the blame on, like, the designers and, you know, the actual people who are doing the grunt work, and then the people who make the platforms for which he designs for. So he's saying, you know... Basically, I could have made Fable a better game, but, you know, the limitations of the Xbox, it's just, you know, the Xbox isn't the same as my brain. You know, my brain has a different game, and what I port onto the Xbox, that's where the problem lies. It's the Xbox, not me.
And I love that he's essentially also blaming everyone that works for him for not realizing his visions. It's like, guess what, Peter Molyneux? Do we need to explain basic brain function to you? Like, the stuff that goes on in your head, your brain is one of the greatest computers ever invented. The stuff that goes on, it can't really be replicated one-to-one.
Yeah, exactly.
I can imagine a lot of shit in my head right now about super dumb games that will never come to fruition.
Oh, God, yeah. Like for instance, we'll be at a panel this summer for...
Comic-Con.
For Comic-Con,
yeah. We'll be at a Hall H in Comic-Con, and we'll have more than 5 fans. And
yeah, it'll be a packed house. We'll play the Super Dumb Games theme live for people.
I feel like I've imagined all this stuff in my head, and really the empirical decay has happened on your end, Chris.
What's funny, though, again, despite all of the missteps that may have happened between vision and actual game, I think he's still a good designer, obviously. But to hear what he says for instance, with Fable, he says, Fable for me was this beautiful, incredible, amusing, funny, artistic, wonderful gem of a game that anyone could play, that tugged on the heartstrings, and that was instantly engaging. The gem that was in my mind has never come to be. It's always flawed in some way. I thought Fable 1, when you consider that it was the first game I ever did of that type, wasn't bad. It was hugely flawed in some senses, and there were technical issues like the animation didn't work, but it wasn't bad. I think Fable 2 was a step in the right direction. I think Fable 3 was a train wreck.
It was.
So, I don't know. If any of you aspiring game designers out there, I think the takeaway is that everyone says that you should, you know, tap into your imagination and don't put any restrictions on, you know, the things that you can envision. And I think the takeaway is that we need to rein that in. Imagination is overrated. Think about how complex the game is in your brain, and let's simplify it so that we can actually play this fucking game and not have a piece of drivel like the stuff that we played from Molyneux. All right. I was on the NeoGAF forums, and I got interested in the release of Castlevania Lords of Shadow.
And I was only interested in it because, you know, whenever I see a game that has been going on for so long, like Castlevania or Metroid, I'm always interested to see how are they faring these days, because I think the source material is always the best. You know, the first game is usually the best, and then from there, it kind of goes downhill until they can reinvent themselves, especially on new platforms. But this week, I'm on the NeoGAF forums, and Castlevania Lords of Shadow, they have a review thread in there. And Tanner, I'm just curious, how do you think that game has fared critically? Not just with gamers, but from the critics themselves.
I think it's sitting at... I think it's probably in the... I'm in between the sixes and the sevens.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it's in the 70s on Metacritic.
Okay. As it stands right now, it's roughly between a 5 and a 6.
Wow.
Because like IGN gave it a 6.5 out of 10, GameSpot 7 out of 10. Kotaku, no. That's what they gave it. They gave it a no. Eurogamer, 5 out of 10. Edge, 4 out of 10. GamesRadar, 3 of 5 stars. The main complaint is that they say that it's a clunky game. It doesn't satisfy you as a sequel on any level. You know, they mean well by it, but the execution is just, it's mediocrity at its very definition. You know, it's interesting to me that people, I don't know, if you're a game designer for the Castlevania series, I would imagine that they're just pumping a shit ton of money in that to placate fans, unless I'm completely misguided and fans will just buy anything. Is that what it is? They just pump out shit because fans will buy it because it says Castlevania? Or do they have a responsibility to all of us gamers, whether we've played Castlevania only the one time back in 1989 and haven't touched it since, or if we've kept up with the series this whole time? Don't they have an obligation to make sure that the franchise succeeds? I don't know. It's weird to me that they're just pumping shit out.
Yeah, the Japanese design and companies have had a pretty poor track record maybe over like the past decade with their key franchises like Sonic, Resident Evil, Castlevania have all been in a lot of ways run into the ground. Like each of those has a standout that almost seems, you know, amidst the pile of really poor games, like it was a fluke.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what's gone wrong there. You know, Nintendo is totally fine. Every game they put out is incredible, but maybe it's a difference of Nintendo has the time and resources to dedicate to make games good. Whereas in these other companies like Capcom, they just have to like pump out these key franchise games and they just cannot get the attention they need. It's unfortunate. I mean, when, you know, for people that are pre-Pokemon era, there was this whole strain of Japanese game development that was so exciting and so beyond anything that was going on in the States and risky and crazy. And that just isn't quite sustainable anymore. And it's sad because that's been replaced by American developers who are far more formulaic.
Our last top sizzler, and this is a quick one, but I had a question for you about it. The news came out this week that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg will be writing and directing Console Wars. I was curious, though, have you read the book Console Wars?
No, I've read similar books that describe that period. I never found it particularly interesting. I think there are probably better stories to tell, but I guess this book must have framed it in a really interesting way. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because if you remember, there was that HBO, it was like a mini series that was trying to shed a light on the late night wars. I think that might have even been what it was called, where they're talking about the David Letterman versus Leno dispute. And to me, it just kind of sounds like they're rehashing it, except this time it's the corporate world of video games. So
yeah,
I don't know if it'll be any good. I mean, I trust Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's judgment, but yeah, we'll see what happens. Hot off the wire, ladies and gentlemen. This is straight from the PR Newswire. This week, there wasn't as much dumb shit, but I thought I would let everyone know that, number one, every so often I like a bag of Fritos, and I think most people do.
One of the best chips in the world, Fritos.
Yeah, and every so often I'll get crunchy Cheetos. I don't get the puffed bullshit. I get the crunchy stuff. I need to feel it between my teeth. I also... Actually, no, I haven't. I was gonna say I also indulge in a Pepsi. I don't drink pop. I haven't had a Pepsi in years. I can't even remember what it tastes like. But for those of you who care about this stuff, PepsiCo and Frito-Lay North American Division and Activision Publishing Incorporated, a wholly owned subsidiary of Activision Blizzard Incorporated, if you're into the stock markets and the trades and what have you, NASDAQ, that's Activision Blizzard is ATVI, so you can call your broker ASAP and get in on this because they announced today, which was a couple days ago, a promotion that brings fans the ultimate way to get involved in the award-winning Skylanders franchise. I don't know what that is, but it's award-winning. I just didn't catch the award show, I guess. For the first time ever, Frito-Lay and Activision are providing fans with the unique opportunity to choose and name a new hero that will appear in the next Skylanders game slated for release in 2014. In addition to naming honors, the winner will receive a $100,000 scholarship. It does not even state that you have to be a student. I don't know what use that money would be for me. I don't go to school.
You can just toss it at University of Phoenix and, you know... get an MA in gun repair in like 3.5 weeks.
The thing that's great to me about this story, though, is that I really hope somebody... It actually got me thinking about back in junior high. We had a friend who isn't really our friend anymore, but we all had to create crossword puzzles. And at the end of the week or whatever, after we had all created our crossword puzzles, the teacher picked... their favorite one. And the teacher picked this kid's crossword puzzle, which had hidden within it the words dick and like pussy and stuff like that.
Of course. Yeah. As did everyone else's.
Right. Well, once it was discovered, of course, some kid ratted him out and was, I think, suspended from school or at least put on some kind of detention. But anytime there's some kind of a promotion like this, I always hope that there will be a name that's put out there that somehow is something bad. Like, it's another word for vagina. Like, the new character's name is, like, Clunge. And everyone's like, yay, Clunge. But over in England, they're like, you know, Clunge means a vagina, right? And this guy just sneaks in, Clunge underneath the radar, gets $100,000, done and done.
It is kids' duties around the world to try to do that. I mean, when you see these contests, it's a call to arms.
Yeah.
For the most creative and deranged kids to try to come up with something awful. And of course, if you can design the look of this character... do your best to Joe Campbell this motherfucker and get and get a bell end in there somewhere.
Yeah. So between now and March 21st, fans 18 years and older can visit the website that's on the PR Newswire. I'm not giving them any traffic. Fuck that. They can select one of three potential heroes they want to see come to life in the next game. Once their selection is made, contestants then submit a suggested name and a 200 character or less inspiration for the name they chose. I mean, this is just... begging someone with creative writing experience to go at it. So that's, I don't know. I mean, that's about all I got for news.
We left off in segment one with a little tantalizing tidbit about games in which... you could create. And I want to do a loose interpretation of that. I just want to discuss any kind of game and any way you want to frame creativity within those games and our favorite memories from our gaming past around that issue. The thing that really comes to mind for me is there was a period back in probably the mid to late 90s where I got big into modding my games. And it's something that I haven't really done that much since, probably because I've just never been able to afford a good enough computer to play computer games. And back then, I always had a decent enough PC because we had a family computer. So... the last time I can recall, the last two times I recall that I got really heavy into modding games was Rainbow Six and Morrowind.
Oh, yeah.
And both of those games, I have even fonder memories of mods that I would download and combine in these weird ways than the actual games themselves. So it's like you'd start with the base game and you'd plow through it and then you just go on the internet and find, and in these days it was the Wild West, like you'd go on the most bizarre sites and download corrupt fucking files with Trojans in them, and just...
You're on Wear sites.
Yeah, and you just shove them into your computer, and it would blow up, and every now and again you'd get a decent mod, but often they were these janky, broken disasters. And there was this one that me and a friend downloaded for Rainbow Six. It was a mission that someone had created, and he did all his own voice work for the game. And he had to be no more than 13, 14. And it's one of the great things about video games is how it incites people's creativity and nurtures it. And this kid, you know, he's in some basement, like I was in a basement. He created this mission for me that I'm playing that was horribly designed. That was like a take on the conflicts in the Congo in Africa. And to this day, I remember when you fired it up, he had created some shitty computer graphics, you know, title screen with like a lens flare and whatever, you know, a horizon with water and, you know, whatever the fuck. And the first thing you hear is this kid come over, you know, in shitty recording on one of those stick mics.
Yeah, like I used to record on.
And he's like, Operation Cold Turkey. And he's like debriefing this mission as like some colonel. And I believe when I first fired this up, I was sitting there with my friend Byron, and we were waiting. And it, from then until now, 20 fucking years later, whenever we play an online game that's like a shooter, one of us inevitably will be like, Operation Cold Turkey. Like, and I want to meet this kid and shake his hand and be like, you know, job well done, son.
My interpretation, I'm glad you allowed it to be a bit looser, because mine goes, actually, it goes back to board games of my youth. One game in particular, the game Mousetrap, had you craft the mousetraps as you went through it. Do you remember this?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was like... And that was one of the most exciting things, though, about it, because you're making this whole Rube Goldberg thing out of it. As a kid, I didn't know what that was, but I just liked the interconnectivity between each trap, and I got a huge kick out of that. And I know there are similar games to that where you would have to build things up, you know, off of the board itself, and just to operate in that three-dimensional space was a big step up from, say, you know, playing Chutes and Ladders and Sorry and.
But did
like
you ever get Mousetrap to work? Because I owned it. I honestly never got it to work, and it still didn't take away from the fun of it. Like so, apparently there was a game involved there, but all we'd use it as was a kind of Lego set that you just try to get to work.
Oftentimes, that's all you used it for. You rarely played the game. I think the idea behind the game is that like. You land on spots. This is off the top of my head. I think you land on spots which help you put together traps. And the goal of the game, I think, is to trap the other mice, the players you're playing against, in those traps and take them out of the game. And it's just through creative ways, you know, like dropping down a cage on top of them or knocking them off the board with a guy who does a backflip off of a fucking whatever he does. You know, just crazy stuff like that. But oftentimes, by the time you were done building the thing, you were already done playing with the game. You're like, fuck this, I'm done. The other thing that I was reminded of, and this goes into the computing age, was back on MIRC, Internet Relay Chat, if you ever did MIRC at all, I was big into it, so was my brother. I think I've talked about this before. But we got so big into it that we began making scripts that you could download, and there was a whole website that had very popular ones like Next Gen. And it wasn't just like a skin to make the program look different. It actually had operations within the program to execute things. So when you came into a room, it could play a MIDI or a WAV file. Things like that were built into it, right? So what we ended up doing was my brother made Hostile Defense, which basically if somebody was trying to get into the room and took it over, because sometimes that would happen, like somebody would get what we called back then, they would be opt in the channel. And when that would happen, they would kick everyone and take over the channel. If that happened, in the event this happens, you would download Hostile Defense, which then breaks back into the channel, de-ops them, re-ops everyone else, and puts everyone else back in the channel. It was a huge hit. My contribution was, I was the voice guy. So if you downloaded it, you got to hear my kid voice say, like, Hostile Defense and stuff like that.
I imagine your brother in like a pair of sunglasses, you know, a Detroit Tigers cap turned backwards and like a neon tank top on, like,
yeah.
You know, programming this, yep. This script. Did you ever use any nefarious scripts in games?
Like cheats?
Yeah, like in online games at all?
Yeah, the big one was Boba Fett's trainer in Diablo. That was a huge one to have. And when it wasn't popular, it was great because you just equipped yourself with the best gear. You killed people in one hit. You were able to defeat Diablo at any time and shit like that. It was great. Once everyone else had it, the game stopped being fun anymore. But yeah, I've used trainers before in games.
I never cheated in an online game. And I think it had more to do with the fact I never could figure out how. Back in the Wild West days of online games, there was a lot of cheating that would go on. Mm-hmm. A lot of, like, you know, latency manipulation and Quake and that kind of thing. But I never really understood how to do it. But in AOL, that was kind of my IRC. I used the shit out of, like, illegal whereas, you know, programs that would do various nefarious things, and I hung around with people that did serious shit, like stealing people's accounts and
Jesus
crazy, like hacking of AOL itself to give themselves mod privileges and shit that, like, is like criminally offensive.
It's nuts.
And I think one of them even got caught once.
Oh god.
But you know, talking about Molyneux and creativity in games, I'm the type of person that loves the idea of building things in games and always has, but never quite has the time.
Yeah.
Or maybe innate ability to do what I want to do. And I teased Mario Paint at the top of the show, but that I could vividly recall getting that game and the excitement of watching what others had done both in the game demos and in Nintendo Power and thinking, like, I'm gonna be all over this shit. I've got my mouse, right. I got my mouse pad, I'm gonna sit down. And I couldn't do anything. Like, you have these visions of grandeur in your head, and then you sit down with the fucking paintbrush. You know, and all you can do is stick figures, essentially. And
right.
There's no mechanism to do more than that. There's no tutorial that teaches you artistic techniques to do anything like what you've seen, and it's always a disappointment. And the same thing continues to happen. Like Little Big Planet, I fell in love with the idea of making stuff in that. And it just was too complicated. I really think the only game that I've actually made stuff that even comes close to what I've envisioned was Minecraft. And that's really a credit to the marriage in that game of simplicity of mechanic and then complexity of what can be done with that mechanic.
Well, speaking of delusions of grandeur really quickly, I bought the game Neverwinter Nights under the auspices that I was going to create a D&D campaign that could be played by my D&D gaming group, and I, you know, they would download what I'd created, which would be an entire dungeon and a town up above it, and there would be text, you know, that has like NPCs talking and shit like that. I was going to create this whole thing. I think about 5 minutes into it, I was like, fuck this, and I was done. Stop playing, didn't touch the game ever again.
Never mention it to your gaming group.
It was over. But that happens so often. If you're not one of these types who's great at this sort of shit, then I'm a consumer when it comes to this. I'm clearly not a content creator.
You've got, I mean, in these old tools required some sophisticated understanding of computing. You know, to make Operation Cold Turkey, that kid had to know how to program and know how to, and had to create art. So then, you know, mm-hmm. there was so much complexity. And I think I suspect we're entering a golden age of this very thing. This is one of those things that hasn't quite been realized. And I think Minecraft has pushed the issue. And we're going to see a lot of tool sets come out that make game creation and modding much easier to do and much more robust. And I'm excited for it. It's probably the thing that I'm most excited about moving forward in games is to see, first of all, how Minecraft's procedural generation impacts games, and secondly, how its model for creation impacts games.
First, when it comes to Minecraft, there is a, it's one of my favorite games too, but there is an element of boredom that sets in after a while, because you craft stuff, and even if you're playing like with the Feed the Beast launcher, where you can load up all these different mods and all these different skins or whatever you want to call them, you know, to make the game look different. Even if I can build an infinite number of things, I always end up going back to the same shit. I never really explore fully what's at my disposal. And maybe in a way I paid the price for it, but I kind of just end up getting bored with it. And in the same way, but using a different mechanic, I would get that way about MMOs like Warcraft, where you would have a crafting skill tree that you could become good as an armorer of some kind, or good at fishing and stuff like that. I don't recall really caring much for doing that stuff, because a lot of times the reward wasn't high enough for me. There wasn't enough there. Like, okay, I can craft this sword, or I can be an, you know, make a certain type of armor, but I could always find better armor than I could create, is how it always worked for me. I was never ahead of the curve when it came to that stuff.
Well, see, I think what you're getting at is, there are different types of players, right? I mean, there are people who, the reason why they play games is to make stuff. You know, and there are other people whose, you know, primary motivation is just become the best, or, you know, another person is just all about exploration, you know? So
yeah,
you're probably just not the type who really cares about creating. Like, the reason why you play Minecraft, I would suspect, is more that you like playing with others and making discoveries.
Yeah, it's a social experience. I mean, the most fun I have in Minecraft is when, like, our friend Casey and I just build boats, we equip ourselves with some armor and a sword, and we try to explore biomes and find stuff. That's when I have the most fun.
Like, there in game theory, there's this guy named Richard Bartle who was one of the designers of one of the original MUDs and went on to be a kind of game theorist about role-playing games. And he came up with four essential player types, which is killers, you know, PvP types, trolls, hackers, cheats are also part of this. Achievers, you know, the people who have to be the best, beat things, get there first. Explorers, and he kind of ropes creators into this. I actually think they should be different, but these are the people who are all about just discovering the world. And then socializers would be the last. And these are people who are mainly about forming different connections, role playing. They're often the people who manage guilds and that kind of thing.
Interesting. Where do you think you fall?
I'm definitely an explorer. There's no question.
Yeah, I'm an explorer with a bit of leaning toward that socialization, but only among friends. Like, I know you were big in the guild stuff when we were in Warcraft, and I was just more about talking to you and, like, the friends I had in real life. I didn't really care about meeting other people online. It was more of a play. It was, you know, it became IRC with a gaming component for me, in a way.
So those of you in the community, Ben, I would love for you to email us your stories of creating in video games. Superdumbgames@gmail.com would be the address. And, you know, I'd like to start involving the community, Ben, a little bit more in this final segment and kind of giving their recap of the previous week's segment as we move on with whatever that week's segment is.
You know what the hard thing about that is, though, is you need listeners for that.
So. Yeah. That we're still figuring that element of the equation out.
As it stands, we're just talking into microphones at one another.
So go to superdumbgames.com. Social media links are on the left. Go to iTunes, rate and review us. We'd appreciate it. And we'll see you next week.
Dumb games.